Last year, we did this exercise together as a community where one of the pieces was an invitation to say what sort of themes or ideas we thought we might want to explore together as a community. I've returned to that list lots of times. I'm going to continue to do so. My hope is that we're always exploring something that touches on every person's journey. But having said that, I mean, I also know that it would just be foolish for me to sit down in front of my computer screen and start writing as though I knew what was in each person's mind and heart and life experience. You know, I mean, that would just be arrogant in the extreme and wrong. It just wouldn't be true. So what I do instead is I go back to that list, because that came from us. That came from things that I know we're interested in because we said so. And I should also say that having people reach out to me anytime, and we did that deliberately together as a community, which was great, but having people reach out to me anytime on their own initiative to say, can we dig into this, whatever that this is always welcome. I think if we're serious about exploring what we believe, then in the end, really, there is nothing that is off the table, so to speak. Even if it sometimes takes a while for me to figure out what might be a potentially good way or a good time to engage a particular topic or idea. So, one of the topics on that list was an invitation to explore some of the connections between, or the nature of the relationship between Christianity and Buddhism. No one likes to be remembered for their mistakes, but those of you that were in the room may remember that the original way that this occurred on the screen was for me, invitation for me to compare Christianity and nudism. It was a typo, which we're past that now. But I tried. Like, I sat down and started the research, you know, and it was just going nowhere good. It's like Buddhism it is. The spirituality of nudism, it's a real thing. You might not want to explore it. Yeah, your search history is going to get really messy really fast. Christianity and Buddhism, it shall be. I want to open that up a little bit this morning. Now, as is usually the case when we do any of these things here at the table, we're just going to be scratching the surface. That might be a little bit frustrating for people in the community that have already put some significant time and energy of their own into related explorations. If that's the case for you, I apologize. However, one of the rich possibilities arising from that same likelihood is that this little talky bit might encourage other conversations, and that you might discover that the person that is sitting beside you is in fact a deep well of insight, or that they share your curiosity, or you might find out that their perspective is nothing like yours. I had a recent conversation with someone in this community who described a really quite substantial issue about which they have a radically different point of view than someone else in the community. And they summed up the ideological differences in that conversation, and then they said something along the lines of, I couldn't disagree more, but I love them. I couldn't disagree more, but I love them. And I think we could talk like until the end of time about how to live well in a divisive age, and we might never come up with a more concise and powerful articulation of how to do that, how to live well in a divisive age, than that. I couldn't disagree more, but I love them. There's no way to walk that path without choosing to love those with whom we share community, and then on the strength of those relationships, doing the work of having sometimes hard conversations and of hearing things that don't sit easy for us. As we're going to see, one of the deep commitments shared by the Christian tradition and Buddhism is that of peace building, both within ourselves and between ourselves and others and with the earth, the world that we all share. And that feels to me like a pretty great place to start. If this particular sort of theme, the relationship between Buddhism and Christianity, if that sort of theme and conversation is interesting to you, you might have already noticed that there's been a bit of a boom market for books and podcasts on the topic. I find it consistently fascinating how that happens, how there's some idea or there's an issue or a perspective that seems to gain momentum until it kind of bubbles over and it starts to feel like it's showing up in lots of places at the same time. This is basically the premise behind Malcolm Gladwell's book, Tipping Point, for instance. Other people have noticed this. It's like there's a whole bunch of people thinking about the same thing at the same time, but they're not necessarily thinking the same things about it. It's pretty fascinating how this happens. One of the books that has had considerable impact in the conversation about the relationship between Buddhism and Christianity in the last 25 years or so has been Thich Nhat Hanh's work, Living Buddha, Living Christ. Now, in our fast-moving world, that book is ancient. I think it was first published in 1995. It's hard to believe it's still relevant. Thich Nhat Hanh, some of you, if you have encountered his work and teachings, might have encountered him as Thay, which is an honorific that means teacher. But Thich Nhat Hanh is, among other things, a prolific author. He's written over 100 books, over 70 in English. That's a lot of thinking put to paper. Probably one of the best-known Zen Buddhist monks and peace activists in the world. Now in his either late 80s, early 90s, but well into that season of his life, has since suffered a stroke in which he's lost his ability to physically speak, but is, I think, otherwise in reasonably good health for his age and living his days in one of the monastic communities he helped to found. I could add a lot of details and accolades to that, but a few minutes on Wikipedia can top you up on that if you want. It's quite interesting, not least of all because of how his peace building has been both a source of great praise, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, among other things. That was a year that the committee didn't offer a prize, but also some real controversy. Not everyone, including not everyone in the Buddhist community, has been altogether excited about his work. But he's done a great deal to bring Buddhism, and in particular Zen Buddhism, into the West. In any case, Hanh opens this particular book, Living Buddha, Living Christ, with an interesting story about our tendency as human beings to wall off what we believe from other systems of belief. The chapter itself is called Be Still and Know. The section in the chapter that I'm going to read for us this morning is called Religious Life is Life. 20 years ago, at a conference I attended of theologians and professors of religion, an Indian Christian friend told the assembly, "We're going to hear about the beauties of several traditions, but that does not mean that we are going to make fruit salad." When it came my turn to speak, I said, "Fruit salad can be delicious." I have shared the Eucharist with Father Daniel Berrigan, and our worship became possible because of the sufferings we Vietnamese and Americans shared over the years. Some of the Buddhists present were shocked to hear I had participated in the Eucharist, and many Christians seemed truly horrified. To me, religious life is life. I do not see any reason to spend one's whole life tasting just one kind of fruit. We human beings can be nourished by the best values of many traditions. Goes on to write, Professor Hans Kung, someone whose teachings I know I've referenced here before. Professor Hans Kung has said, "Until there is peace between religions, there can be no peace in the world," close quote. People kill and are killed because they cling too tightly to their own beliefs and ideologies. When we believe that ours is the only faith that contains the truth, violence and suffering will surely be the result. The second precept of the order of interbeing, we'll probably end up talking about that order of interbeing idea a little bit more. The order of interbeing is fascinating because it's almost like a Buddhist explanation for the same thing that Christians tried to explain in the Middle Ages with the Trinity. It's super fascinating. The second precept of the order of interbeing, founded within the Zen Buddhist tradition during the war in Vietnam, is about letting go of views. And this is that precept. Quote, "Do not think the knowledge you possess is changeless, absolute truth. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. Learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to receive others' viewpoints." Close quote. That's the end of the precept. To me, Han says, this is the most essential practice of peace. I find it intriguing, I find it informative that it's in the teachings of a Vietnamese Buddhist monk that I find such an engaging path forward when it comes to the possibility of peace between religions. Given the origins of Buddhism, this probably shouldn't be a surprise to me. It's an interesting story. Buddhism's founder, Siddhartha Gautama, lived in northern India around the mid-500s BCE. So this is a culture where Gautama would have grown up surrounded by gods. His father was the ruler of a small kingdom near what is now Nepal. and a child of privilege. He grew up shielded by the relative luxury of that privilege, and yet the stories about him say that he wasn't spoiled by it, but grew up good and kind, got married, had a son, all within the sheltered confines of the palace. And then he began to question the value of what increasingly seemed to him to be his idle and luxurious life. And so one day he sort of steps over the boundary and he goes outside of the royal park and he sees four sights that change the course of his life forever. He sees a sick man, an old man, a dead man, and a monk. In seeing the first three, he realized that even the most rich and powerful ruler can't escape the suffering of illness, old age, and death. And in seeing the monk, he took as a sign that he should leave the palace to search for an answer to the problem of suffering. And so at the age of 29, he cuts off his hair, he puts on beggar's robes, he becomes a wandering holy man. He studied, fasted for 6 years, at the end of which he was exhausted and almost dead, at which point he decides that the extremes are not the answer, and he begins to seek what we still know as the middle way. And one night he sat under the now famous banyan tree meditating and saw the meaning of all things, experienced enlightenment, and from this point on, he was known as the Buddha. Now that's already an interesting story, remarkably akin, among other things, to the origin story of the significant Christian monastic Saint Francis, who also eschews wealth and privilege and finds himself speaking to the world around him in ways that are fascinatingly similar to the story we encounter about the origins of the Buddha. But here, the story goes in an importantly unique direction. The Buddha is deeply motivated by his quest to find an answer to the problem of suffering. That's like the core of his mission. He does not want to waste time on speculation. He wants action. When you think about Buddhism, I'm not sure if action is necessarily what comes to your mind. It's probably more likely for many of us that meditation is what comes to our mind. By the way, meditation is not passivity. Anyway, he wants action. So, he doesn't try to answer the questions about whether or not God exists or how the world was created. And the reason that he doesn't do that, he says, is because to do so, love this, I'd put this on a bumper sticker and put it on my car. To do so, if it would fit, would be like a man wounded by an arrow refusing to relieve his pain until he knew how many feathers the arrow had. Did you track that? So, having answers to those kind of questions, he said, does not help relieve the suffering. Now, if you feel like you have to question the merit of that perspective, let's just go back to what Ray said in our community time about the Christians and conflict, and Jane, who had to sort of adroitly and on behalf of the community say, how shall we navigate this truth as a community with some grace? How can we acknowledge both the fact of what Ray was talking about and the fact that if you self-identify as a Christian and don't want to live that way, what do you do with that? How do you identify, right? So here's Gautama saying, I'm not going to count the feathers. I actually want to do something about relieving human suffering. I want to figure out how to live so that that can happen. He goes on to teach, and this is all oral tradition because of the time period. So it's a long time before the Buddha's teachings get written down, but they do eventually. But he starts to teach his disciples the things that have come to be known as the three universal truths, the four noble truths, and the eightfold path, and together sort of known as the Dharma. So, I mean, again, we'll kind of get to more of that another time. But I think we should pause, first of all, to consider the important possibility that it's not a helpful idea, at least not in this conversation, to think of Buddhism as a religion at all. The Buddha, having realized that all the gods could not bring an end to human suffering, lays out a path to peace that does not involve divine mediators. Instead, what he asked people to do is take responsibility for the workings of their own minds. He taught that it is the desire for a pain-free life that is the real problem, because life is never pain-free. And the sooner we learn to accept that, the sooner our suffering would end, not our pain. This is an interesting distinction, in broadly speaking, in Buddhism. It's not about the end of pain. Pain is. But suffering, Because suffering in this teaching is often a measure of how much we want things to be different from the way they are. That's also, by the way, the best short definition of stress that I'm aware of, the gap between what we expect and what we experience. Same idea. So, contrary to a lot of popular opinion, the Buddha made no claim to be a god. He also never denied the existence of God. There just wasn't anything really for a big G God to do in his teachings. This is quite possibly one of the most important aspects of how Buddhism functions relative to other religions, and I think uniquely in how it functions relative to Christianity. And again, we're going to come back to that later. The things that happen to us, the Buddha says, are a natural consequence of our actions. If we do not like what is happening, it's up to us to change. I remember a high school rock and roll song with "If your world is all screwed up, rearrange it." In it, I was part of hosting an event this past week that included a panel discussion on climate change, and in particular on Christian perspectives on that issue. And at one point, the moderator asked the panelists if they thought that climate catastrophes could be fairly understood as an apocalyptic judgment of God. Yeah, that's sort of how the room there reacted a little bit too. It was like, should we chuckle about this question? Is this a serious question? Where are we going with this?
I know several parental units who ascribe to that.
Yes, and the question didn't come from nowhere, of course. So fair enough. Now, it was interesting to listen to the panelists' response. One of them said, yes, they thought so, but not in the way that they had been taught. And then he went on to say what they'd been taught about this idea of apocalyptic judgment of God was something like, God is watching, there's a line, and if you cross it, God's going to whack you, and the whack is the apocalyptic judgment, right? It's the climate event, it's the storm, it's the flood, it's the car crash, it's the whatever, it's the, you know, pick a nasty thing. Not that, but rather something more along the lines of, if you pour boiling water down your throat, it's going to hurt you. Now, here's a rhetorical question. Does "if you pour boiling water down your throat, it's going to hurt you" framed as an answer to the question, could a climate catastrophe be understood as the apocalyptic judgment of God, does that answer strike you as more of a Christian answer or more of a Buddhist answer? How we answer that question is likely tied pretty snugly to what we think of when we think of God. The more absolutist and subsequently often the more interventionist our view of God is, the more likely that perspective will sound less Christian. That leads to some pretty interesting questions in my mind, like, can you have a religion without a God? If you can, what takes God's place? In this other frame of reference, who's going to, let's say, run the world? Who's going to forgive sin? Who's going to punish evil? Who's going to grant eternal life? All things that traditional Christianity would ascribe to God. That's a corner that it's hard to get out of. So maybe let's just abandon the language of religion / not religion for now and think in terms of systems of belief. What sort of common ground is readily seen between the most visible versions of Christianity and Buddhism? So let's start there. Again, a short list that'll perhaps leave many things out. Both Christianity and Buddhism recognize the centrality of suffering to the human experience. Both emphasize compassion. Both seek lasting peace. It's a pretty lovely common ground. And of course, there's distinctives. Now, I should say at this point that I feel like I have some of the kind of authority that comes with lived experience, as narrow as that might be and personal as it might be, but I feel like I have some of the authority of lived experience from which to speak about Christianity. I have no such experience with Buddhism, so I'm largely working with ideas about it that I've come across in my own reading and study. And also, I would say that both of those worldviews or systems of belief have taken on a lot from their respective contexts. We'll talk about that another time as well. If you don't think Christianity's taken on things from its context, you just haven't paid much attention to the history of Christianity, because it's all over the place. So the short version is that both of these systems of belief have evolved, or to put it another way, there are lots of kinds of both. And so if you feel like this, what I'm about to say is like, really doesn't do one or the other of those systems of belief justice, then that's fair enough. But in terms of distinctives, here's a couple to consider. In very general terms, when it comes to a big theme like salvation, the Buddha could be said to show his followers how to achieve it. While Christianity teaches that Jesus achieves it for his followers. Of an existential question like what's wrong with the world, the Buddha teaches that the problem is ignorance. Christian tradition says that it's sin. On the matter of what is the self, the Buddha says it's impermanent. Christian teaching says it's destined for eternal life. Now, when you lay it out like that, it can look like we're talking about oil and water. These things just aren't going to mix well. And yet, to refer back to that spate of books and podcasts that I mentioned earlier, there are more and more people for whom both work and work relatively seamlessly. Why is that? Sometimes I get quite frustrated by how little time I have to pursue ideas. I get that this is a complaint of the privileged. Having said that, my experience at this point in life is that over and over again, I realize how little I know, and how small my perspectives are, and how much I long to still learn. I am not giving up. In fact, I hope I'm just getting started, but I also know that the clock is ticking. And sometimes I experience that in really concrete ways. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. There's a thinker, writer, professor named Paul Francis Nitter, someone I've just recently learned about. Nitter was the Paul Tillich Professor of Theology, World Religions, and Culture at Union Theological Seminary in New York for a long time. He's 80 now, but he continues as the emeritus professor of theology, world religions, and culture for that seminary. He was formerly the emeritus professor of theology at Xavier University in Cincinnati, so that's a fair bit of kind of Christian thinker cred, you know, right there. He published a book in 1985 called No Other Name? No Other Name? And since then has been widely known for his religious pluralism. He's got a bunch of books on this sort of thorny question of how to live deeply into a tradition, in his case, Christianity, but to do that as a generous-hearted pluralist. I want to know how to do that. And I've just heard of this guy for the first time. Well, sometimes I really do feel like I got ripped off by some of my early theological educators because they were more interested in guarding their perspective than they were in equipping me to be a fearless explorer. Now, to be fair, this information about Nitter hasn't been hidden away somewhere. So maybe I just wasn't ready to rock my own belief boat, you know? I wasn't really looking for that, and that's why I didn't find it. In the end, I believe that I'm responsible for my adult choices about what I swallowed on critically. But some days, I still feel a little bit ripped off. So there you go. Enough whining. One of Nitter's books is called Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. I'm just trying to imagine some of my undergraduate educators recommending that book. I can't get there. I can't do it. I lack imagination. In that book, Nitter describes what he calls the, quote, double belonging that drew him deeper into his commitment to Christianity at the same time that it led him to become a more devoted member of a Tibetan Buddhist community in the U.S. When one of his seminary students at Union Seminary came to him and asked him if this was spiritual sleeping around, he took the question seriously. And his answer to that student was that he understands his core identity to be Christian, but that this identity was one that flourished through mixing it up with others. We're going to pick that idea up next week, but for now, I just want to come back to that fruit salad for a moment. I'm not sure how this works in your kitchen, but in my kitchen, a fruit salad has both several kinds of fruit and it has a dominant flavor. When I make it, the dominant flavor is usually peaches. When I dig into the fruit salad, I can recognize and savor the dominant flavor, but my experience of that flavor is informed and made much more interesting by all the flavors around it. It's delicious. And the salad is not being untrue to what it is, nor are any of the fruits within it doing so. Like any other metaphor, this one has all kinds of limitations. And there's also all kinds of ways that it might be helpfully considered. So, at the risk of overtaxing it entirely, always a danger, how about we all just go home and chew on that for a while, and then we'll dig into it again next week. Peace.